Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist here with you today to talk about, well, what everyone in America is talking about today, and that is gun violence and the school shooting that just occurred a few days ago in Connecticut. I did not originally intend this last pre-holiday podcast to be about this topic. I was, in fact, going to continue dissecting these ideas around sex, gender, and sexuality, but I can't continue that line of discussion now in light of what's been preoccupying me and almost everyone else I know now for the past few days. So first, I'd like to send out my condolences to the people of Connecticut who lost children, who lost family members, loved ones, and to my fellow teachers who I think may be feeling a little insecure right now. I can't help but look at this as a teacher, and it occurs to me that when I chose teaching as my career path, that I did not realize that it was going to be so dangerous. I don't know why teaching has become such a dangerous career. And that's why I'm doing this podcast today, to be honest with you. It's not anything I've thought about too deeply or researched previously, but I myself am asking some questions today. And so I'm going to share with you my own process of figuring out how to understand this tragedy. The question that occurs to me, well, there are many questions that occur to me, but a lot of it is, of course, about gun violence in the United States, which is excessive and remarkable. I know that I have listeners all over the world who are probably wondering right now, what's going on here in America? Why do we have this excessive level of gun violence? And those of us on the liberal side of the political spectrum will tell you it's because guns are too readily available. They're freely available. In my anger, the other evening I was reflecting on the idea that I could go out any time and get a gun. No problem. Just go down to the local gun shop, local gun show. I've got a license, I've got identification, I have no criminal past, no record, no psychological problems, of which I'm aware, at any rate. And sure, I could get a gun. And I'd like to think that I wouldn't use it. But, you know, I can also think back to a time when I was younger, much younger, and I lived in a different place and I had a different life, and I used to get very angry. And of course, I like to think, well, you know, I never would have hurt anybody, and I never did. But when you have a gun available, readily available, doesn't that just increase the likelihood that you could hurt someone? I mean, just statistically, right? And I'm sure that if I looked it up, that the statistics would bear me out, that there's more casualties from gun violence in households where there are guns than in households where there are no guns. So it just seems, you know, sensible to me. Many of us believe that guns are just too freely available in the United States. As someone who grew up in an East Coast city, it's always been my belief that guns are too easy to get and that bullets are too cheap. The question of gun control has always resonated for me at an urban level. It's about violence in our cities. That's something that I am intimately familiar with. So the arguments about gun legislation have always seemed to be about yet another binary, something I talk about a lot, yet another binary between folks like me who grow up in cities where guns kill children all the time and folks who grow up in more suburban or rural environments where they don't see that kind of gun violence, and guns to them, it's about hunting and family bonding and rites and rituals of masculinity. There's a whole analysis there that's waiting to be done. I don't say that in a dismissive way. I say that in a respectful way. As an anthropologist, I'm aware that there is something we could think of as a gun culture in the United States, which is made up of many different groups of people, but some of whom definitely think of themselves as hunters and recreational sports people. That's not my experience with guns. So this dialogue exists at one level in the country, this dialogue between urban people who fear gun violence in the inner cities and suburban and rural people who consider gun ownership to be part of their natural rights as American citizens, and they identify it again with hunting and sportsmanship. There is, of course, a third place where guns happen, and that is apparently in schools. And that is what makes me personally very nervous. I'll tell you that when I began teaching in community college in the state of California, the year of my first employment, I was a roaming adjunct professor. I taught a class here, a class there, and I spent a lot of time driving from campus to campus. I believe it was in my second or third semester of teaching, or perhaps it was quarters, they were quarters back then, that I taught on a campus where shortly upon my arrival, I discovered that the previous quarter, a student had been arrested and jailed for stockpiling weapons with the intention of committing a massacre at that campus. And that's something I learned about, again, probably within the first year of becoming a college instructor, that I was teaching on a campus where a student had almost committed a massacre. And it frightened me. I am, by nature, a friendly, affectionate, demonstrative person. I love teaching, and so my demeanor is typically very happy when I am at my place of work. I enjoy my students, and I enjoy what I do very much. But I will admit to you that there is a very small part of me that decided that first year that I began teaching to be nice to everybody, because I never knew when I was going to say the wrong thing to the wrong person, and that person would come back with a weapon. Does that sound paranoid? It's not paranoid. If we look at the history of school shootings in America, well, I consulted Wikipedia, as we do these days, and there's a list at the end of one of their entries there that lists what they refer to as significant school shootings in America. There are many other shootings, like the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, at the movie theater premiere of the Batman movie this past summer, and the shooting in the mall parking lot of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. There are many other types of shootings, but these school shootings are increasingly common. So there's this list of what's referred to as significant school shootings, and I suppose what makes them significant is that somebody died. And this list of school shootings begins in the 1920s and goes all the way up until just the other day, and there are 125 entries. And of those 125 entries, 124 of those events have happened just since the year of my birth. In other words, since the middle 1960s. With increasing frequency as we come closer to today. What is that about? I literally fear for my life and the lives of my students under these circumstances, and I believe that many people in my position do. I remember coming to class after the massacre at Virginia Tech. The Virginia Tech massacre happened in April of 2007, and 33 people were murdered. The whole country went into mourning, especially people of high school and college age, because they felt it very closely. And I know that teachers like myself also felt it very closely. And I remember returning to class and talking this out with the students, because they brought it up. They were worried. They were upset. And they wanted to know, what were we going to do if something like that happened on our campus? And frankly, I didn't know what to tell them. I teach at a very small school. We have a very small security contingent. And frankly, I'm a teacher. I'm not a police officer. I've never served in the military. I have no training and no preparation. And so when a student suggested in class that the teachers be armed, I didn't even know how to react to that. I wasn't sure whether to laugh or to cry. Arm the teachers? This is the most insane thing that I have ever heard. So the answer to violence is more violence, is to place guns into the hands of people who are not properly trained in not only how to fire them, but when to fire them. It's insane. I did not become a teacher because I wanted to be militarized. Absolutely not. That's not what teaching is about. I can understand why they think that way. They feel unsafe, and so do I. So I have to ask myself as an anthropologist, what is this about? Why is this the situation? Why have there been so many school shootings? Now, this is, of course, a complex question, because the first question is, why are there so many shootings? And the second question is, why are there so many shootings in schools, right? There are at least two different things to talk about. So I could spend this whole podcast talking about gun violence in America in general and basically do a 30-minute rant against the gun lobby and the NRA, but that's not what I'm here to do. I'd much rather try and understand how Americans feel and think about guns because I am at heart a cultural anthropologist. I want to understand American culture and the American point of view about guns while recognizing that it's very varied and people have many different opinions. So I think the best way to go about explaining this to myself and sharing that explanation with you is to look at it from a historical point of view. So I'm going to go there in just a couple of minutes. So the first thing I want to talk about is why these shootings occur in schools. And I have an idea about that. I believe that the school is the one place in American culture that every single person experiences. It is the formative experience of every American life, the school. Not everybody has a consistent family, both a mother and a father, siblings. Not everybody has grandparents. Not everybody lives in a house. There are so many variables in American lives. But everybody goes to school, it's the law, and they spend a minimum of 12 years there. So since this is such a formative experience for every young American, it stands to reason that deep emotions will be invested there. So that to me is a short and simple and probably very inadequate explanation or partial explanation for the violence in schools. It seems likely to me that since everyone has prolonged experience there, that a fair proportion of us will have a grudge to bear with the institution or the people there. Then there is, of course, the fact that psychology is telling us these days that the child's brain is not yet fully formed and that teenagers are capable of some very rash and thoughtless actions. The latest research tells us that young people aren't even really fully prepared to make completely rational decisions until they're somewhere in their 20s. It's just a matter of brain development. In other words, we human beings are not born with fully functioning, adequate brains. The brains grow just like the rest of our bodies do, and our intellectual capacities come along in stages. You cannot expect a teenager to make the same kinds of thoughtful, well-thought-out, well-weighed decisions that an adult would. Of course, young people act much more rashly. We all did foolish things when we were younger because we acted more rashly. So that's my oversimplified hypothetical explanation. Can't even really call it a hypothesis, right? Kind of a guess as to why the schools are the target of so much violence. It's a combination of the fact that everybody spends so much of their lives there, and it makes sense that there's going to be built up anger and resentment in some of us. And then there is the additional fact that young people are more prone to act rashly or irrationally. So as a teacher, I recognize that kids are going to blame me if they get an F. And I recognize that some people really don't want to be in my classroom. And no matter how nice I am, no matter how concerned and helpful I try to be, they're going to hate me, they're going to dislike me, and they're going to blame me for their lack of motivation or lack of success. And so going back to that very first year that I started teaching, I resolved to be as nice as I possibly could to every student because I just don't know. After that Virginia Tech shooting, the school administration pulled the entire faculty into a meeting where they showed us a film about how to recognize a school shooter, how to respond in a shooting incident. And it was very brief and very inadequate, and it certainly did not substitute for training, and it had the net effect of making all of us who taught on that campus incredibly paranoid anytime we saw a young man in a ball cap, dark sunglasses, carrying a duffel bag. So what would I do if something like that ever happened on my campus? What would I do? I have no idea. I like to think that I would be smart, that I would make good decisions, but I have no idea because I have no training. I have no idea. I think that in the absence of any comparable experience, that I would probably be driven by self-preservation and just duck and cover and yell at everyone to do the same. I doubt that I would perform any feats of heroism. I mean, I'd like to think that I might, but the truth is I'd like to live. So I suppose my instinct for survival would be the strongest response. And so I say to my students, I'm sorry, I can't protect you, and I don't know if I could. I don't know if I would. I don't know how I would, and I'm sorry, and that's not my job. You know what? It's not my job. And it's terrible that this is such a dangerous place in our society, but the answer has to be somewhere else. It can't be found in the teachers. What is the answer? I can't say. That's not what this particular podcast is for. So once I moved on from asking myself the questions about why there's so much school violence, the next question I asked myself is, well, what's the American love of guns? What is that about? Why do Americans love their guns so much? Why are we so attached to them? Why is it so difficult to have a rational conversation about gun control in this country until a group of children is murdered? Why has that been so difficult? So that is the larger question that I asked myself. Why do Americans love their guns so much? So I thought about it, and I did a little looking, put a couple of things together. And let me explain something here. As an anthropologist, I have an incredibly broad range of information available, from cultural to physical, biological to religious, just everything across the map. So it's not that I know so much or that I read so much, not at all. It's just that anthropology gives you a good ability to make connections, to answer problems from different points of view, to incorporate many different strands of analysis into the same kind of explanation. That's really all it is. It's making connections. And so in this particular case, I'm going to make some connections about history and culture. So from a historical point of view, Americans were born holding on to their guns, basically. This country has a very unique history because we were founded in revolution by a group of very disparate colonies. The United States of America began its life as a collection of 13 colonies possessed by Great Britain. We had then a revolution to separate ourselves from them. That did not change the fact that we were still 13 different colonies with 13 different identities. And these 13 colonies you can think of as roughly equivalent to countries in Europe, European countries. Some of these colonies, which we now of course call states, are as large as some of the countries in Europe. So if you look at America, if you look at each state as more of a country, then you can see that they're each pretty unique. They each have sort of a culture of their own. And these 13 original colonies, they gathered together in a representative form of government, which gave them each power to contribute to that central government, but they never really wanted to be subsumed under a central government. They wanted to maintain their own identity and independence. So what this created in America is a tension between the role of the federal government in deciding things for the country as a whole and the role of the states in deciding things for themselves. And that tension has always been there. It also means that in America, as you travel from state to state, you will find remarkable cultural differences. You will find remarkable differences in the demographics, the population, the things that people do for a living. America is incredibly diverse. When the Revolutionary War concluded, one of the first things that happened was that General Washington disbanded the Continental Army. He stepped down and disbanded the army. The army had been composed of state militias. When the colonies were originally founded, they had to raise their own militias in order to provide for their own defense. And so the colonies enacted their own laws, which compelled adult citizens to serve in these militias. So you had an identity as a state citizen, you belonged to that state, and if you were an adult male, you were prepared to serve in that state militia. What that meant is that you grew up as a man knowing that you had to know how to shoot a gun. And also back then, you probably hunted for some of your food. You were also, in some cases, on the border of communities with which you were hostile. And by this, I'm speaking, of course, of the Native Americans. So there was this great need for individual Americans to be armed in order to defend themselves and their property and their colonies. There was no army. There was the militia, the state militia. So this is ingrained in the American consciousness. Once the Revolutionary War was concluded and we set about the business of writing a constitution, we had to confront this conflict between those who believed that America needed a very strong central government and those who believed that the states should maintain their own individual rights to make their own decisions with very, very little interference from the federal government. And this today is reflective of some of the differences between the so-called Republican and Democratic parties. Republicans tend to be for what they refer to as states' rights, which prioritize the rights of the states over the federal government. And the Democratic Party in general likes to see a stronger federal government making rules for everyone. The argument behind the Republican point of view is easy to understand. If the people of my state feel very, very differently about an issue than the people of your state do, then why should we be compelled to follow the same rules as you? And from the Democratic point of view, we can't let that happen. Because if we did, then there would still be Jim Crow laws. Now, when the Constitution was drafted, the Founding Fathers fought it out between themselves as to how they were going to reconcile these differences. And one of the biggest places of contention was over the military. The Constitution did not actually form an American military. What it did was it gave Congress the power to call up the state militia at the service of the country. At the time the Constitution was drafted, Americans had a great distrust of the standing army, of an organized military, and that's because they'd experienced so many abuses in the 1600s from folks like King James II, because he believed in what's referred to as the divine right of kings, In other words, kings are entitled to their thrones by the will of God, and everything they do is sanctioned by God, so therefore they can do whatever they want to, and he tried to, which eventually led to the response of the English in forcing the passage of the English Bill of Rights. So as Americans after the Revolution, we had just won this war against tyranny of that form, and we weren't about to do it to ourselves. The United States was born as a nation of people who feared the tyranny of government. Let me explain this a little bit more. There are several things to talk about here. For one thing, the English Navy had a practice of conscription, which included impressment. Okay, conscription, basically we mean the draft. You were forced into service, no matter what. And impressment meant that they just took you off the street and threw you on a ship. There was nothing voluntary about it. As a matter of fact, the British believed so strongly in impressment that they pulled Americans off American ships and impressed them into the British Navy in the 1800s. That's one of the things that led to the War of 1812, a very unknown war, I think, to most Americans. So why would the United States of America want a military? Why would they want to follow in those footsteps of compelling military service? As a matter of fact, the American military was all volunteer until the draft was enacted in 1917. Prior to then, it had been a volunteer military. And then after the Vietnam era, it became a volunteer military again. So for most of our history, the military has been voluntary. So the founding fathers were extremely wary of an organized military controlled by the state. They preferred to rely on the state militias. And because they relied on state militia, it came down to the level of the individual man to own a gun, to use a weapon, to know how to use it in case he was called into the service of protecting his family, his home, his colony, and later on his state, and then eventually his country. It's always been an individual responsibility here in America. There is also, in America, a very deep-seated fear and distrust of the federal government. I suppose it may come from the fact that our country was founded in revolution against a tyrannical form of government, that Americans have always tried to keep their form of government very close to themselves. We've always been a bit wary of the big hand of Big Brother, so to speak, and hence the wariness in some circles of things like so-called socialized medicine. Because it just reeks of this concept that the federal government already has too much power and control over individual lives and freedoms. There are many people today who believe that the federal government is virtually illegitimate in most of the things that it does, that most of the powers it has taken for itself should more properly reside with the states, that states should be more free to make their own rules. There is, in some places, a deep-seated fear that the government will send its black helicopters in to take people's guns away, to take people's rights and freedoms away, much like the British tried with its former American colonies. There are people who stockpile weapons because they expect the government to become tyrannical, and they believe that they have a right to fight back. They look at the Constitution, and they see in that document the idea that human beings have a right to resist a tyrannical government. You see, the problem is that tyranny is not supposed to be possible in a democracy because we have the power, not the tyrant. The people have the power. So there is a recourse to the possibility of tyranny. We call it voting. However, as I said, there is a very, very deep stream that runs through the American subconscious that harks back to our founding and tells us you never know when that government is going to start doing stuff that it shouldn't be doing, and you want to be able to defend yourself and your family. And going back to the revolutionary period, we can see that the British gave their American colonies a great many reasons to hold and stockpile weapons. Again, they would conscript and impress Americans into their navy. They passed the Quartering Act, which compelled American colonists to shelter and feed British troops, who were there, of course, against the will of the Americans. There was a great deal of resistance in early America to the idea of an organized military that was controlled by a central or federal government. There was also a great deal of resistance to the idea that citizens would be unarmed. Why would they give up their only defense? They had just fought a war against a tyrant who invaded their shores and their homes. Why would they give up their guns? Of course, that was a long time ago. Article 1 of the Constitution gives the U.S. Congress the ability to, and here's a quote, provide for the calling for of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. So that's calling up the state militia. And then a bit later, the Militia Act of 1792 clarified it and said, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America, in Congress assembled, that each and every free, able-bodied, white male citizen of the respective states resident therein, who is or shall be of age of 18 years and under the age of 45 years, except as is herein after accepted, shall severally and respectively be enrolled in the militia by the captain or commanding officer of the company within whose bounds such citizen shall reside, and that within 12 months after the passing of this act. So the defense of the United States was completely dependent on these state-level militia. There was no U.S. Army except in the event of war, when the militia were called up and assembled into a collective force. And that is what happened with World War I. In 1917, Woodrow Wilson decided to start a draft in order to deal with World War I. He needed manpower, so they passed the Selective Service Act of 1917, which had to be passed because there were no provisions for a peacetime army, which meant there was no standing army. The act declared that all male citizens between the ages of 21 and 31 would have to register for a draft. And we had a draft in this country until the war in Vietnam disgusted us so greatly that we rejected it and returned to our formerly all-volunteer military. Now, all I've done today is try to explain to myself and share that explanation with you the connection in America between the sense of being American and the idea that you need to have and use a gun. It's built into the founding of our country, into our consciousness. There is so much more to talk about here. The Constitution was written before the establishment of the American military as we know it today. It was also written before the advent of semi-automatic and automatic weapons. It was written when the primary weapon was a one-shot musket, which took quite a long time to load and fire. It was also written at a time when, despite the fact that the country was composed of 13 fairly unique colonies, it was also fairly homogeneous in terms of being largely white, largely Protestant, largely Western European. Our country is far more diverse and complicated now. Our technology is far more advanced. Our cities are far more densely populated. And it's just way too easy to kill too many people too quickly. Gun advocates in the United States often say, guns don't kill people, people kill people. And while on the face of it that appears to be a true statement, it's obvious you can't kill someone with a banana. You need a gun. To my mind, it's the availability of guns that is the problem here. I think it's misguided to focus on the issue of mental health. And I know that's what people talk about. We have to deal with the mental health issue here. But you know what I think? I think everybody has the capacity to just flip out. I really do. I've seen it happen. And so frequently when you read about or hear about these horrible incidents that happen, these people who commit murders, their friends and neighbors say, oh, I can't believe it. He was such a nice guy. He was so mild-mannered. He was so sweet. It's true, because even apparently normal people can be crazy, and even truly normal people can go crazy. I mean, that's part of what makes it crazy. So the thing is, crazy is going to happen. Crazy is always going to be there. Murderousness, murderous intent is always going to be there. But the question is, how much damage can you do when your murderous intent surfaces? If you go crazy and you freak out and you have a moment of bloodlust, well, how much damage can you do with your bare hands or whatever knives or baseball bats are available to you? A whole lot less damage than you can with an assault weapon. I truly believe that almost anybody is capable of this snap. It just depends on what happens to you. It just depends on what buttons get pushed. Even the most sane, loving person will murder you if you threaten their child. I mean, there are conditions that would drive any of us to pick up a gun and shoot it, aren't there? Even the most peaceful among us would use that weapon if we had to defend our families, the people we loved. I truly believe that anybody is capable of just having that switch get flipped, whether it's something that happens to you or just something chemical in the brain. Anybody. It could happen to any of us. And what's important is whether or not you then can go to your dad's closet and pull out a gun. That's what's important. How much damage can you do when it's just you and your anger? Well, a whole lot less, I think, than you can when you've got access to the gun cabinet, huh? The guns are just too accessible. So this is the core conflict. It's the idea that gun ownership is etched in our consciousness as Americans, up against the reality that guns kill children with increasing frequency. And so we have to find a way to compromise. We have to figure out how to bring these two poles closer together. How can we construct an America where people can have their guns and their sense of identity and children don't get killed because of it? We're talking in this country today about banning assault weapons, high-capacity magazines, things like that. Sure. But the truth is that I could go down to the good old gun mart today and buy a gun without any problem at all. I could go to a gun show and buy a gun without any problem at all. And I'd like to think that that's something I would never do, but people do it. People do it. It's just too easy to get that gun and pull the trigger. And so I don't have the answers, folks. I just have a lot of questions, and all I can do is the research to try and answer them, or at least provide potential answers. I'm sure that as the weeks go by, I will think of more that I want to talk about on this subject. There's many more directions to go, but I'm going to end the podcast here and once again send out my condolences to all of the families who've lost loved ones, not just in this most recent incident of gun violence, but to everyone who's lost someone to some of this insanity. I also send out my wishes for strength and peace to my fellow educators who literally do walk into a battlefield every day, completely unprepared for it. I will express my hopes that we in this country find a way to make teaching a safer occupation, to make getting an education a safer pursuit, to make being an American not depend on your ability to buy a gun. Well, that's it. That's all I've got for you today. Sorry, such a serious podcast just before the holidays, but I'd like to wish you all very, very happy holidays. So Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate Christmas. Happy Hanukkah to those of you who have just finished celebrating Hanukkah. Good Kwanzaa to those of you who celebrate Kwanzaa. Whatever it is that you celebrate, good solstice, good Yule, whatever it is, I wish you a happy holiday season and a wonderful new year. I do not plan to be back here with you until after the first of the year, so please do be patient. I will be taking up with holiday friend and family activity, just like so many of you, but I will be back with you shortly after the first of the year, when I hope to start off with something a bit more lighthearted. Now, even though there won't be another podcast until after the first of the year, I would still be grateful for an email or a phone call. The voicemail is 206-312-3526. That's 206-312-3526. Or you can send an email to theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. That's theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. I enjoy them very much. It's really a high point of this whole process for me. I still have quite a few stickers and would be very, very glad to send them out to any listeners who might enjoy posting them around town or maybe just displaying them proudly on their vehicle of choice. They are 4 inches by 4 inches, black and white vinyl, should be fairly weatherproof, so they can be used outdoors. If you need more than a couple, just let me know if you'd like to spread the word about the podcast and the blog site. I'd be happy to help you do that. So go ahead and send me an email, theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com, or give me a call at 206-312-3526. Oh, how I look forward to hearing a voice on that voicemail. There has not yet been a single voice on that voicemail, and I know that there are hundreds of you listening. Someone be brave. 206-312-3526. Leave me a message. I would love to hear from you. Until next time. Be well and take care.
Am I recording?